Solitaire Rose Radio, Episode 6, New Universe, Part 2. I wanted to record this much, much, much earlier, but I knew Solitaire Rose Radio would be something that came along whenever it came along. I wish it would come along a bit more often, but Crazy Comics and Stories, the other podcast I do, is coming out every week. Joe and I are working our schedules, but because of that and the schedule I have, having solo time at home in order to record has been a bit hard to get a hold of. So, what I want to do is go over more of the things I would have talked about in the first New Universe podcast, but my voice gave out. And I'm kind of glad that I was able to take the time, because in that time I have sat down and I have read most of the post-New Universe, New Universe work, if that makes any sense. And I also have some notes on the things that I think the New Universe, some lessons from the New Universe that carried on to comics of the 90s. I talked mostly about these series that were done under the auspices of the New Universe, and I talked a little bit about how it went away. But I have actually now sat and read the three series that sort of wrap up the New Universe. It was a new direction. And to bring you back up to speed, the New Universe was a creation by some of the people at the offices of Marvel. They were tasked with doing something big for Marvel's 25th anniversary. And they wanted to create a new, more realistic superhero universe. However, there were a number of stumbling blocks and a number of errors made along the way. And while many people say that the failure of the New Universe was the cause of Jim Shooter being let go from Marvel, it's not entirely true. There were a number of things that led to Shooter being removed from the editor-in-chief position at Marvel in 1987, not the least of which was that the company was bought by New World Pictures. New World Pictures started as Roger Corman's movie company. It started as New World Pictures in 1970. It was put together by Roger Corman, who had been working for American International, and Corman wanted to strike out on his own, have his own movie company, and he created pretty much the same sort of thing that American Independent Pictures did. Cheap exploitation type movies to play at drive-ins and second run theaters. It wasn't the big movie companies like Paramount or Universal or Columbia. They were more of a, can you make this movie for $25,000? Okay, then we'll put it out. And in the 80s, they were doing very, very well, because in the 80s, there was a huge need for product. You had the blockbusters, but you also had video stores, and video stores needed more product. That's when the direct-to-video movement started. You had some companies that did just that. And New World made a lot of money off this, whereas a Paramount movie would get, they'd get Eddie Murphy. New World would get someone like William Catt, who'd been in a couple TV shows to headline one of their movies, or Grace Jones. They were kind of a third tier. They got their hands on Marvel in 1987, and the odd thing was, when they bought Marvel, they didn't much care about the comics. They wanted the properties. Much like how when Disney finally bought Marvel, it's, you know what, Stan Lee had been out in Hollywood for over a decade, pushing the fact that Marvel had over 3,000 characters, including Spider-Man, Thor, Hulk, etc., 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 and New World bought them up, wanting to exploit those properties for TV shows and movies and this and that and the other. And what happened was, I remember in Comics Journal, when Shooter was removed from the editor-in-chief position, one of the things they said that really soured New World on him was that Marvel sales were dropping, and they were. By 87, Marvel had dropped to number two. DC had just come off Crisis. They had Watchmen. They had Dark Knight Returns. They had a whole bunch of number ones. They were doing really, really well, much like how when they started the New 52, whole bunch of number ones, DC became the number one comic company in the direct market. There were problems inside Marvel as well. There were issues. Creators were leaving, mostly citing conflict with editorial and specifically with some of the bigger names, with Shooter himself. But what I feel, and of course the New Universe failing did not help him in any way. But what the Comics Journal reported back then was that Shooter was increasingly erratic during corporate meetings. And no one has said any more than that in any way. So you don't know if it was they didn't like the ideas he was pushing or what. But New World came in, Jim Shooter was shuffled off, and they attempted to kind of restart the New Universe. And they did it with a book called The Pit. It was written by Mark Gruenwald and John Byrne, and they actually spent money on art, which was something they hadn't done on the regular New Universe books. It was penciled by Sal Buscema and inked by Stan Drake, who it was a comic strip artist. And I just read the book, and there's a lot of focus on a character called The Witness, who is drawn to horrific events. And of course he is drawn to this horrific event, and the city of Pittsburgh is destroyed. And a lot of time is spent showing the destruction and setting up how the United States reacts to one of their cities just being destroyed. It was interesting in that it really felt like world building. There wasn't a whole lot of character stuff. There wasn't a whole lot of plot. It was, this thing has happened, and we are now resetting the table. This was then explored in a number of New Universe books, but the next big event was The Draft, which was another prestige format comic. You know, this was back when comics were a buck and a quarter, and these were all 350, square-bound, 48 pages. And I was working in comics retail at the time, and they were pushed as, this is a big deal. Anything that was in that prestige format was considered to be, they were spending big bucks on it, because they were spending big money on the production itself. The Draft was written by Mark Gruenwald and Fabian Nyasasia, who'd came, much like Peter David, he came from the sales end. This was one of his earlier works. A lot of his work on the New Universe was his earliest work. And it was one of those, well, he's around, he could do it. And he was early in his career, so there were the budgetary concerns. It was drawn by Herb Trimpe, who for most of his career draws like other artists. But in this book, he used more of his, what I consider to be his normal style, when he's not being told, you need to draw like Jack Kirby, you need to draw like this, you need to draw like that. It was a very classic illustrative style. There were a number of inkers. There were lots of inkers on this, and the art is inconsistent page to page. You kind of feel like they really had to rush this through. It starts in the middle of a story, and it introduces a whole bunch of new characters. Kind of a superhero squad of people who get drafted. It's all set up. Now, whereas The Pit was just dull, this was more very flat, very much the cliche of here's backstory on character A. Now they've joined the military and are in this group. Here's character B. Now they're in this group. Character C, etc., etc., etc. This rolled directly into a book called The War, which was written by Doug Murray. Doug Murray was best known at the time for writing the comic The Nam, which was, while he was writing it, was excellent. It was one of the best things Marvel published in the 80s. It was a story of what was going on in Vietnam as told by a group of soldiers, and as soldiers would rotate home, they would bring in new soldiers. The problem was that once Shooter left, the book wasn't shielded from sales and editorial as much. So by 1989, 1990, you had the Punisher in it. You had less of the sort of, I don't want to say moral ambiguity, but it was more, it felt more realistic. And then after Doug Murray left the book, it became almost as bad as that god-awful John Wayne Green Beret movie, where it's rah-rah USA, everything we do is great, more like Rambo than realism. And I completely quit reading it after the creators, who were admittedly more popular but far less talented and far less willing to deal with the complex issues that came up in Vietnam. They just wanted to tell stories of good old American soldiers who shot up bad guys. So The War, 4-issue prestige format book, and I don't remember the artist's name. I didn't write it down, but the art was terrible. It was just terrible. It was cartoony. You've got this story of global tensions rising, war about to break out, missiles being... This was at sort of the tail end of the Cold War, and one of the issues ends with Russia and the U.S. and China, and Cuba, exchanging nuclear missiles. It was very dark. The problem with it was it devolved into a superhero story, and it became very much the group that was pulled together in the draft needs to figure out who to punch in the face. And this was considered the closing of the new universe, and it didn't wrap anything up. It didn't tell us where the white event had come from. It didn't wrap up any of the ongoing plot lines other than after the pit, the world is on the brink of war. War is about to break out, and eventually a cosmic entity steps in. And if you could get them out of quarter bins and you're really, really, really interested in the new universe, go ahead and pick it up. But otherwise, it looks terrible. The story is bland. It just doesn't work. And at that point, it pretty much felt like the new universe was over. However, the new universe wasn't over, as Mark Gruenwald, who was an editor-writer at Marvel, he was very big on using everything that was laying around. I know there are a lot of people who really like Mark Gruenwald. I always found his stuff to be... I found the ideas interesting, but the execution was always poor. Characters weren't really characters. They just sat around and were either involved in fights or were just living exposition dumps. He brought back the Star brand in his comic Quasar. And just so you realize how long he played with this, the Star brand first showed up in Quasar in issue 31. And he finally wrapped it all up, I think, in issue 62. So that's over 30 issues he played with bringing the Star brand into the Marvel Universe. And toward the end of the story, there was a big 4-issue crossover called Star Blast. Now, there were 12 main parts, And over in Crazy Comics and Stories, I gave a very humorous review of it. I'm going to go over it in a little more detail in this. But these are everything that's wrong with comics in the 90s. They're awful. They're just awful, awful, awful books. It starts off with issue one. There was a four-part miniseries, and the first two parts were by Grunewald and Herb Trimpe. And Herb Trimpe was drawing like Rob Liefeld. Everyone had huge torsos, giant legs, teeny heads, no feet, massive guns. It was terrible. And what it is, the story starts with a bunch of intergalactic pirates. They're looking for the Star Brand, and they kidnap the Watcher. Now, just so you know how horrible this is, I wrote down the names of some of the intergalactic pirates. Xylem, X-Y-L-M-M. Kodobak. Threkker the Skullhugger. Nyborn the Monitor, who, halfway through the first story, his name is changed to Nygorn. Skeletron. Insidio. Fabricant. This issue is a huge information dump. The pages are ugly. It was hard to get through. And the Watcher gets kidnapped. The Watcher, who's, you know, more powerful than... he's basically on a par with Galactus, gets kidnapped by a bunch of space pirates. The story then goes to Quasar 54 by Mark Grunewald and John Hebink, who, his art isn't as bad, but it's still not very good. The note I wrote is, if these were someone's first comic, they'd still be in therapy. Grunewald's writing is just painful. What did I write here? Oh, here's a exchange between Quasar and Dark Star. Hey, long time no see. No time for your American humor. Long time no see. Trying to figure out where the humor is in that statement. A lot of exposition. Basically, it's bringing all the characters in who are going to be fighting against the Star Blasters, or what are they called? Yeah, the Star Blasters. It then goes to Secret Defenders 41, which is written by Ron Mars and Tom Grinberg. Grinberg, who broke in as kind of a Neil Adams clone. Ron Mars recaps everything, and in that one, in his recap, the story makes more sense than it did in the previous two issues I'd read. Mars is able to kind of boil it down, say, here's what's happening. He creates a conflict. The problem is, when the Hulk gets to the character that they're supposed to fight, beats him in one punch. So really, again, tons of exposition. Nothing really here about the Star Brand or the new universe. It's more about these space pirates doing something to Earth. I think, if I remember right, they'd put a rocket on the moon and were trying to push the moon into the Earth. The story then goes to Namor number 46, written by Glenn Herdling and Jaw Fisherwood. This is an ugly, ugly comic. It's not the Liefeld ugly. It's just ugly. It's not good to look at. The story is all over the place, and it's just references everything going on in all these other stories and previous issues of Namor, and stuff going on in the Fantastic Four, stuff going on in Secret Defenders, stuff going on in Quasar, stuff going on in Star Blast, that you really, by the end of it, you don't know what has happened. It's lots and lots of setup and exposition, and here's what's going on elsewhere. It then comes back into Star Blast 2. And in Star Blast 2, my note is, look, more standing around. It's 32 pages of characters standing around. Nobody's fighting the bad guy. No one. They're all just kind of standing around talking about what's going on. And it's a huge crowd scene. He's got the Soviet super soldiers. He's got Quasar. He's got the Eternals. He's got the Inhumans. And it's none of the characters, I won't say none, most of the characters are not identified by name. So if you don't already know who they are, it's just a bunch of people in costumes standing around talking. From there, it goes over to Quasar 55, where Nightmask appears. Nightmask, one of the characters of the new universe, who starts to set up what's going on in the new universe Earth and kind of fills us in on what has happened since the end of the war. One of the things that really annoyed me as a longtime comic reader, they have the character Scar, S-K-A-R, who is kind of an intergalactic mercenary in this story. Scar was in the War of the Worlds Killraven story, which did not happen in the Marvel Universe, and there's no explanation given for how this character gets from Killraven's universe to our universe. He's just kind of there, and it might be a case of, oh, well, you know, I'm looking through the official handbook of the Marvel Universe. There he is. Might as well use him. Namor 47. Same creative team. It's still an ugly book to look at, but at least the story has a beginning, middle, and end. And it's the first one of these. Well, Secret Defenders had a beginning, middle, and end, but it's the first one that feels like they set up the conflict, the characters go through the fight sequence, they defeat the villain, and the story moves forward. And I talked about this in Crazy. They have the statement of ownership, which tells how many books are selling. And this was at the point when comic sales were in free fall. And I could tell this because the sales on the book were 113,000. And back then, Namor was considered a midline book. Wouldn't Marvel be happy if their midline book sold 113,000 now? But the issue in the old statement of ownership, they would go, this is the average we have sold through the year. And then they have a thing, which is, this is what we sold nearest to publication date, and the nearest to publication date was 91,000. So the overall average was 113,000, but the nearest to publication date was 91,000, which probably means that earlier in the year it was selling much better, probably in the 130 to 150, and was just dropping through the entire year. It then goes over to Fantastic Four 385 by Tom DeFalco and Paul Ryan. The thing about this is I remember dropping the Fantastic Four around this time because it looked horrible and it was boring. And I knew they'd done a story where Reed Richards was dead. And I knew that it would go until at least Fantastic Four 100. And it's, you know, I didn't want to read 20 issues of them looking for Reed Richards. Because that's how Marvel did it at the time. They would start a story around about 30 to 40 issues before the anniversary story to pay off in the anniversary story. So if the story leading into it wasn't going to be interesting, you're stuck reading it for 2 to 3 years. The thing is, I remember dropping it at the time because I hated the art. The art was better than anything else I've read so far in this crossover. And it was more the Fantastic Four are called in to help Namor fight one of the space pirates who's on Earth doing stuff. From there, it goes over to Star Blast. This one is written by Mark Gruenwald and drawn by Grant Miehm. Sorry, I don't know how to pronounce that. Who did some work over at DC. I don't know if he did a whole lot over at Marvel. Here's the names. You ready for the names? Skeletrauma, one of the pirates. Insidio the Ovoid. I will say this, though. The art was so much better than Herb Trimpe's Liefeld knockoff. Still, it's not good. These are just not good. But they're setting up more of, okay, Quasar's girlfriend has the Star Brand. We're getting more scenes in the new universe. Something is going on there. We don't know what yet. And one of the Soviet super soldiers dies. Which one? I don't know. They never give his superhero name. Not once. And I went back and I read the previous issues. Not once. We know that his civilian name is Michael. Do we know what his superhero name is? No. Not in any of the issues leading up to this have they given his superhero name. Now, I know a lot of people at the time talked about how Jim Shooter was not a great editor, that there were a lot of creative people who did not care for him and did not care for his dictates. But one of the things he did that everybody should listen to is in every story, you identify the characters, let the people know who the characters are, and then you set up what the conflict is. I remember when he was here, he talked about having this huge fight with Chris Claremont over an issue of the X-Men where Storm was referred to by four different names. And he said, Shooter's point was, a new reader is going to be confused because you call this person Storm. You call her Goddess. You call her Aurora. And you call her Windrider. Well, what the hell is her name? And that's my problem with this. Here's a guy, he wears a mask and a superhero costume, and the only name he's referred to is Michael. And there's a scene where he dies. And there's, well, first off, there's next to no impact to it because all he's been is just kind of been standing around in the crowd scenes. But also, which superhero is he? We don't know. If you're going to have this big dramatic moment, you have to build to it. You have to get us to know the character, care about the character, so when he dies, it means something. The next spinoff is Quasar number 56. That's set on the new universe Earth, and there was one nugget that I wrote down that the new universe Earth is in another multiverse. Not just another universe, but another multiverse. Thankfully, no one has picked up on that since, because Marvel's already got enough alternate Earths. Could you imagine if they add in an alternate multiverse with more alternate Earths? I know Grunewald was trying to make it so that the new universe was very, very much removed from the Marvel universe, but you've already set up that there's a multiverse, your alternate Earths. Just have it be an alternate Earth. It then crosses back over into Fantastic Four 386 and Neymar 48. I couldn't make it through those books. I could not. I was reading it all in one sitting, which is probably a mistake. But by this point, I was just so tired of the way comics were told in the 90s. One of the reasons I read comic books and I watch movies and TV shows and things like that, but really for comics especially, it's I want to have fun while I'm reading the book. Now, that doesn't mean it has to be all sparkles and joy and unicorn. I want the dark dramatic moments. I want a story, but I want to have fun reading it. When it becomes a chore, I don't want to read that book anymore. And I remember dropping so many comics around, in the 90s. They weren't fun to read anymore. It felt like a job. If I want to read something that's hard to read, it had better be something important. I'm not saying this that I read nothing but fluff. I read David Foster Wallace. I read Harlan Ellison. I read James Joyce. My project for this year, I want to read all of the Charles Dickens books I haven't read, even though they're very pulpy and poppy. I read a lot of information-dense books. I've just read Drift by Rachel Maddow and Twilight of the Elite by Chris Hayes. Those are information-heavy books. And I'm not going to say that they were fun. I was reading it for knowledge. But I'm not going to sit and read a superhero comic for a dissertation on anything. unless it's by Alan Moore or Grant Morrison, because they can make it entertaining. These books were just, they were a chore. And by this point, I was tired of reading 90s comics. I just was. So I went to Starblast number 4, which we've talked before. This was unbelievably late. This was shockingly, shockingly late. I have not been able to find. I researched everywhere I could think of on the internet without going into Usenet to see shipping dates. But I remember this book being six, seven, 8 months late. And when it comes out, you could tell that it was a rush job, even though it was so late. There were multiple artists. There were, I think, 4 or 5 artists credited. And for inks, they said, you know, did many hands or diverse hands or practically everybody. And you could see panel to panel, there were huge shifts in tone. And again, it looked awful. It was just an awful looking book. And so much standing around and talking. I think this is the issue where the Watcher said, okay, well, I'm here now to see what I'm going to see. And it's been all these issues where the Watcher's been kidnapped. We have to free him. And the Watcher just goes, okay, well, thanks for bringing me here. And just breaks out and just stands there. So the central core of the conflict, you wave your hand and make it go away. You get a fight between the characters of the Marvel Universe and the characters of the New Universe. It's blissfully short. In the end, the entire New Universe is brought into the Marvel Universe, but the Star Brand is sent back to the New Universe. Now, here's the thing. You've had all this build-up. This is the big story to do this big change. It's all done in one page. The very last page, the New Universe Earth comes into the Marvel Universe and is going to be orbiting the Strangers, the star the Strangers planet is at, and the Star Brand goes back to the New Universe because it's too powerful, and this is all done on one page with the Watcher just explaining everything. And then this happened, and then this happened, and then this happened, and then this happened. And I remember as I read it going, and this guy's an editor. The guy who wrote it is an editor, and he doesn't know the basics of story construction. So I read it, you don't have to. Basically, what it is, they've brought the New Universe and all its characters into the Marvel Universe, and later issues of Quasar, they seal it off. That's right. They seal off the New Universe Earth so that nobody can get to it. Oh, what a mess. And that was the last anyone had anything to do with it other than the Quasar stories that followed. Once Quasar ended, no one had anything to do with the New Universe for a long, long time. It was forgotten. Now, In the 2000s, what Marvel did, they brought in Warren Ellis and they gave him a job of look through the catalog, find things that you can use and revitalize. That's what we're paying you for. Now, this gave us Next Wave. There were some other things that he did. But one of the things that he did that I read and frustrated me to no end was New Universal. New Universal was Warren Ellis pretty much doing the New Universe again. However, he had it make a lot more sense. It was a full issue of setup to where the White Event happened. A character was given the power of the Star Brand, and the world reacted to that. And he slowly brought in other characters. But in New Universal, he said that whenever the White Event happens, certain things are created. So New Universal came out in 2006. It was 6 issues. There was The explanation was that the sudden changes to Earth were triggered by the contact with the new universal structure, which, when an Earth gets to a certain point, the new universal structure will hit it with a white event, and in that white event, certain things are created. The structure is assembled by an ancient race, and they modify several sentient beings to perform specific roles. You've got the Dreamer, Nightmask. You've got Justice. You've got the Star Brand itself. And he played with this, kind of setting things up. And the six issues, completely unlike the 90s stuff I read, they took the six issues, they introduced characters, they introduced setting, there were different changes in this world. Hillary Rodham Clinton was president. Paul McCartney had been assassinated instead of John Lennon. You know, little changes like that to let us know that this is a different Earth. And then he stopped with issue six. Now, what was supposed to happen was, with issue, it was supposed to be a 12-issue series. And then as they got near issue six, they said, okay, we're going to take a break between issue six and issue seven. So it ends on a cliffhanger, and then issue seven never, ever, ever comes out. The sales on it were okay. They weren't great, but they weren't terrible. But Ellis never came back to the book. And I believe it was like either 3 or 4 years after it ended, they said, yeah, it's never going to be completed. Okay, fine. So Ellis did a good job of making the new universe, which really was kind of this random mess. He sort of gave it a structure and a reason for the white event, and a reason for the character types that appeared. They each had a role. The problem is this role was never explained, but each character had a role, and he had set up sort of he'd set up an alternate Earth that somebody could play with. Now, in the Avengers, Jonathan Hickman has decided he is going to play with it. He has taken the ideas from New Universal and is now applying them to the Marvel Universe, where there has been a white event, I imagine, and the aliens that are part of the New Universal structure are brought into this as well, and they're explaining to the Avengers why certain things happen, and I believe it's going to tie into a much bigger crossover that will be coming out later this year, but I'm not entirely sure. So that's kind of what happened at Marvel with the new universe. Now, there were lessons to be learned from the new universe. A lot of lessons. One that I don't think anybody has learned since. Well, I'll pull that back. There was one lesson that I think one person, Jim Shooter, learned that no one has learned since. And that is, you don't introduce a new line of books all at once. After Shooter left Marvel, he was involved in an attempt to buy Marvel when New World was trying to sell it off because, well, let's just say that by the end of the 90s, the 80s, the B and C movie business was not doing as well as it was in the early part of the 80s. And New World needed to generate cash, so Marvel left New World. Shooter attempted to put together a bunch of financiers to buy it. They were unsuccessful, so Shooter formed Valiant Comics. Now, at Valiant, you can see echoes of the new universe. Well, one of the first things Shooter did was he went out and he got a couple licenses. He got Nintendo, and he got the WWF, which were both fairly big licenses at the time. I worked at Shinders during this time, and I can tell you that when we got those books and put them on the shelf with kids' magazines and stuff, They sold very well, but if you put them over with the comics, they didn't sell for shit. The problem was newsstand distribution wasn't the greatest, so those didn't do very well, but Shooter had also got his hands on the Gold Key characters, Magnus Robot Fighter, Dr. Solar, Turok, Dinosaur Hunter. Those were really the three core ones. So when he started the Valiant Universe, it really, to me, when I look back, and I know the story about the creation of the new universe and how Shooter created Valiant, Valiant was really the new universe done right. Shooter had an overall plan. They brought in characters slowly. It was, okay, we're going to have a Magnus Robot Fighter comic. Oh, okay, that's doing well enough. Now we're going to introduce Solar. And Solar, if you go back and read it, it really feels like the White Event done right. You have a superhuman who becomes nearly all-powerful, and how does the world react to that? And then more books come out over time. I think it took them about a year to get all of the 8 initial Valiant books out and running. Whereas with the new universe, it was, there's your 8 books right there first month. And I think because of that slower introduction, because it was, okay, here's one book. All right, now here's another. Now here's another. It didn't feel like you had to go to the store, and they were $1.95 at the time. So it didn't feel yet like you had to spend $16 just to start reading this stuff. It was, oh, okay, here's, I buy in this, it's $2. Okay, in a couple more months, oh, here's another book, that's only $4. And it slowly built over time. And Shooter had an overall plan for it. To my mind, I know there are a lot of people who love the Valiant universe, especially under Shooter, but I remember picking the books up and looking at them, and they were a lot like 80s Marvel books where Shooter had a heavy hand, where they just were kind of dull and talky, a lot of talking heads. They weren't what I wanted in a comic, so while I'll never say that they were terrible, because they weren't, I've read them. They're readable. They're interesting. They're not as bad as the other stuff that was coming out at the time. They're just not what I look for when I pick up a comic book, especially a superhero style comic book. So, but I think that was kind of Jim Shooter doing the new universe right. Now, there were a number of other companies that I think did it wrong. And when you look at the 90s, you see it. So many companies who were starting a new line of superhero books and were introducing them all in the first month. And all of them flamed out and were gone by, I would say, 2 to 3 years in. You know, Malibu with the Ultraverse. Yes, part of it was they got bought by Marvel, but even before they got bought by Marvel, the books were dropping like flies because it was, okay, we're starting our superhero universe. Here you go. Here's 12 books in the first month. Boom. Or all of the different imprints that Marvel and DC tried out. The 2099 was, boom, here's a bunch of new books. People still try it. When they are going to start a new line, it's boom, here you go. Here's 8 new books. Here's 7 new books. Here's 5 new books, all in the first month. And I think when you do it that way, you're forgetting the lesson of the new universe, which is you can't just drop a bunch of books on the market, because people will look at it and go, well, it's almost like you either, it's an all or nothing buy-in when you do that. You can either go, oh, I'll buy them all, or I'm not going to pay any attention to it. I'm just going to ignore it because, well, you know, it's 8 books, and I don't want to start reading another new universe. I'm very interested to see how the Valiant reintroduction goes. I've read some of the books. I find them interesting. I think I would like them more if I cared more about the characters. But they're well-done books. I'm not going to say they're terrible. I'm not going to say they're boring. They're well-done. When I read them, I enjoy them. I don't know if financially I want to jump into a whole nother universe. But it's kind of the legacy of the new universe gone wrong, that when people introduce a new line of books, it's almost like they feel like they have to do them all in one shot. And history shows it just doesn't work. I think that's one of the problems with DC's New 52. Boom, here's 52 new books. And it drew a lot of attention, got a lot of press, but is it going to maintain over time? I don't know. There were a lot of people who I know who saw it as, well, this is a good jumping off point. And we'll see how that works. The other legacy of the new universe, even though it was a failure, it was part of that trend to, we want to put superheroes in a more realistic setting, which still continues to this day. And it was a very 80s thing. I remember the build-up to Watchmen was, this is what it would be like if there were superheroes in the real world. And I think that was a lot of hype at the time, because you read it now and it's a science fiction story. It's not, you know, ultra-realistic superheroes. It's a good science fiction story. When comics got dark and gritty in the late 80s, early 90s, it was, we're trying to make it more realistic. You could decide if that's what you want. I know when I pick up a Marvel comic, the only realism I want is internal consistency and internal realism. I don't know if I want to read a realistic Spider-Man. I want to read Spider-Man. I want to read him in the Marvel Universe. There was a trend in comics in the 80s toward more realism, and I think the new universe kind of tried to tap into that. But when you go and you read the books now, the promise that Jim Shooter made of, you know, more real, it's the world outside your window, I don't think it held up to that. I think there were a number of flaws in the initial execution. But one thing that fascinates me, and it's why I was very interested when someone said, oh, you know, go back and read the Warren Ellis stuff and tell me what you think of that. I had ignored the Warren Ellis stuff because Warren Ellis has become one of those writers who, I don't read his stuff till it's done, because he leaves books halfway through. And I know that it was years ago where he had a hard drive crash, but even recent stuff, he will start a series and it's almost like he loses interest and wanders off. I don't want to pay for part of a book. When I pick up a novel, I don't want to read and get to chapter 50 and the writer just has lost interest and the story ends without a conclusion. So I didn't pick up New Universal because, well, Warren Ellis has this habit of leaving books without finishing them. And guess what? He left the book without finishing it. In sitting and reading it, I'm glad Marvel is picking up, because he was able to find diamonds in the dross. He took what had been done and figured out how to make it interesting, which is a real gift and a real skill. And I'm glad that Jonathan Hickman has picked it up to play with it. And I'm also glad I read it, because a lot of what Jonathan Hickman was doing that I thought was, wow, this is a fascinating, you know, blah, blah, blah. He's just picking up the stuff that Warren Ellis did. Don't get me wrong, it's still great stuff. And I like how he's using it. And the story still blows my mind when I read it. But a lot of the stuff about how there must be a dreamer and there must be justice and there must be this and the aliens out in the new universal concept, who, when Earth is ready, this happens. That all came from the Warren Ellis stuff. So I'm very glad I read it so that I've got that idea and I know who to give credit to. So, new universe, wrapping it up. It was a massive failure. It was really a massive failure. And even though it didn't cost a lot of money, it tarnished Marvel's brand. for the first time, Marvel had a kind of a huge failure. They had put a, they didn't put a lot of money, but they put a lot of their reputation on the line with this. And I think it was really kind of one of the cracks in what was called at the time the Marvel Zombie, which, you know, now there's all these jokes about Marvel Zombies. But it really was at the time there were people who would put on their subscription list all Marvel. And anything from Marvel would come out. Now, their Epic was different, but the new universe had the Marvel banner across the top. And new universe was the first time you had people who had checked off all Marvel on their subscription list would then come in and go, yeah, I want the Marvel stuff, but I only want the stuff in the Marvel universe. And once you put a crack in that, I get everything, it becomes easier and easier for a comic fan to go, well, I don't want that, and I don't want that, and I don't want that. And in the 90s, Marvel really, really hurt their brand with all the splinter groups like the Marvel UK and the 2099 and all the little subgroups they did, to where now there's nobody out there who will put on their subscription form all Marvel. DC was able to do it with the New 52 when it was, oh, okay, all the New 52. But that seems to have faded as well, too. And that was more of a jumping on marketing type thing. So the other thing, the other lesson I think that we can get from the new universe, which is an odd lesson, is nothing at Marvel ever goes to waste. Every concept, everything they own, everything they've done, they eventually will reuse. Part of it is, as their corporate philosophy, hey, this has to show up every so often so we can keep the copyright on it. But I think it's also a, even the dumb ideas, we could go back and we can get something out of it. We can use what we have in our history, which as a longtime comic fan, I enjoy a lot. I remember when I first started reading comics, they brought the Patsy Walker characters into the Marvel universe, into the superhero universe, by having Patsy Walker become Hellcat. And that tied in with Millie the Model and Tessie the Typist and that stuff. But Marvel always seems to have that history of, you know, we got this out here, we're going to reuse it again. In the recent Iron Man, Death's Head shows up. Death's Head, a character from Marvel UK, which hasn't shown up forever and ever and ever. Bringing that character in, kind of revamping it, reusing it, using it again. So, if there's anything out in Marvel that you've read, that you liked, but didn't make it, just be patient. Everything eventually comes back. Well, except Skull the Slayer. I don't think they're ever bringing back Skull the Slayer. Want to thank you for listening. This was the solo podcast. Joe keeps threatening he's going to do a solo podcast and hasn't talked about it much. I've got a few solo podcasts where I've done the research, so you can expect them to come a little more often. I want to try and get at least one or two more out before the comic convention next month. And yes, there is more Kirby coming, and also the first episode of the complete history of EC Comics. So once again, thanks for listening, and I will talk to you soon.